So this research was funded by the National Institutes of Nursing Research and a small institutional grant at our institution. And I declare no conflict of interest or monetary gain from this research. Well, here in public health nursing land, we have an ongoing challenge, and that is that we continue to serve people that have health disparities. And we're here at APHA talking about those disparities. We're focusing on social justice. And we public health nurses confront this every day. At the same time, resources for serving families are diminishing, and in many cases, whole programs are being slashed. So it is imperative that we maximize scarce nursing resources and optimize client outcomes with the resources that we do have. Much of my research is focusing on public health nurse home visiting programs, and some people call that case management. But these home visiting programs have been widely employed to improve life course trajectories for disadvantaged families. However, much of the time, the outcomes of these programs have been studied using a black box approach with nurse visited as the intervention condition. So that we have some gaps that we need to address. First gap is intervention patterns within the black box have not been studied. So what is going on in that nurse visit? And second, we know from some of our data that we have improvement at the end of public health nurse home visiting, but we don't know when or how that improvement occurs and for what kinds of problems. So we need to look at what are interim outcome indicators during the episode of care. The instrument I've been using in my research is the Omaha system. It is one of the ANA recognized terminologies, and it has been widely adopted in clinical documentation systems in public health nursing settings. And we also have a grassroots public health nurse-led community that exists to advance the data and practice quality using the Omaha system. So we have multiple research and program evaluation examples which illustrate these issues. And here's a little picture of the Omaha system. And I'll tell you just a little bit about it so that you know how to fit the pieces together when I start talking about the findings. There are three components of the Omaha system: problem classification scheme, the intervention scheme, and the problem rating scale for outcomes. Now, the Omaha system is a valid and reliable instrument, and it's all based on terms and definitions, and it helps us describe what we do in public health nursing in a standardized way. So when we talk to each other, we know what we're talking about. The Omaha system has 42 health concepts. They're called problems. I'm sorry about that, but that's how that's what they're called. But they're really defining 42 different aspects of health, and it's a comprehensive, holistic view of health in four domains: environmental, psychosocial, physiological, and health-related behaviors. This research really looks at the interventions for those 42 health concepts. There are four, count them four, kinds of actions that we can do using the Omaha system that we can describe the 42 problems. So you can see right now that the Omaha system is simple and easy to grasp. The four actions are teaching, guidance, and counseling, treatments and procedures, case management, and surveillance. And then the last part of the Omaha system tells us how bad the problem is or how good. A Likert type ordinal scale of 1 to 5 for three different dimensions of that problem: client knowledge, client behavior, and client status. Introducing a new concept that I had to dream up for this funding source, something called stabilization, a proposed interim improvement indicator. And the reason I say I've dreamed this up is because literally our funding sources for health trajectories research, and we had to look at interventions and outcomes over time. I had intervention data over time, but I did not have outcome data over time. So this is a new concept that I'm saying should be defined as follows: an intervention pattern, K characterized by a combination of actions delivered simultaneously during nurse-client encounters, followed by surveillance actions only during a nurse-client encounter. So if you can imagine that a public health nurse might be addressing a concern with a client, say, for example, their income, and they would be teaching and helping them connect to resources and checking in to make sure that those connections are being made and doing all of that at once, and then something happens and the only thing that the nurse is doing then is just checking in. No more teaching is being done, no more case management is being done. My thought was, maybe what happens is that nurses work with people in multiple ways, and then when change occurs, then they just check in to make sure change is continuing. So that was my suggested interim outcome improvement indicator. The sample was an existing data set. I had family home visiting records from a local Midwest public health agency that I collected over a 6-year period from 2000 through 2005. There were 1,390 clients, primarily mothers and infants, and a total of 75,788 interventions in the data. For the adults, there were 720 adults, and they received the bulk of the interventions. About 70 interventions per client over about 7 visits, and the mean number of interventions per visit was about 12 and a half. For children, 670 children, 40 interventions per child, about 5.5 visits, and about 8 interventions per visit. So the adults were mainly women. There were a few dads and grandpas, but most of these are mothers or aunts or grandmas. They can be adolescents and they can be adults. Mean age 23. Mostly Caucasian, mostly not married. And then mostly babies for the kids, and half boys, half girls. Here are the most common problems addressed with the interventions in the study. And this, usually with my research, I look at the client as the unit of analysis, but in this case, I'm looking at the problem as the unit of analysis. So these are the most common problems for the adult clients: caretaking, parenting, income, antepartum, postpartum, residence, family planning, substance use, mental health, and abuse. So we're looking at high-risk families here. They're living in poverty, they're taking care of children, they're having babies, and they have a host of psychosocial and physiological kinds of problems. Children, we mainly see the problem growth and development because we're watching them and trying to help them optimize their growth and development, but we're also doing surveillance constantly for neglect and abuse. Here is a very interesting look at intervention patterns. And remember what I told you earlier about the 4 intervention actions that we can use in the Omaha system: teaching, guidance, and counseling, treatments and procedures, case management, and surveillance. I bet you can imagine that public health nurses think that they do a lot of teaching, guidance, and counseling, and indeed, they reflect that in their documentation. The blue of these bars is teaching, guidance, and counseling. The green on these bars is surveillance. The red is case management. And so how these are percentage bars. So on the x-axis, those are the weeks that the data were reflecting. So weeks 1 through 46 typically had enough interventions in them that I could make these 100% bars go across. And the pattern is very stable for the people who start out at the highest level of status. So the people who come in functioning, the highest functioning folks are in the lower right corner there. And you can see that they have a very, very predictable intervention pattern. They're getting a ton of teaching, guidance, and counseling, the least amount of surveillance, and the least amount of case management. In contrast, the folks that come in with the lowest status, the people with severe signs and symptoms, those folks have the least teaching, guidance, and counseling in comparison to the surveillance and case management that is needed, and that fluctuates quite a bit across the week. So this is a much more unpredictable family situation, and really interesting to see this reflected in intervention patterns. So within those intervention patterns, we were looking for the problem stabilization. Did this really occur? And yes, we found out that it did for 30% of adults and 20% of children. We're looking at the time to stabilization being approximately half or less, in the case of children, of the time to the final discharge. And here are the stabilization Kaplan-Meier curves for these stabilization outcomes for adults. So looking at these lines, they're different colors for different problems. And let's look first at the top line. It's the darker green, and that is the caretaking parenting problem. And you can see that that problem rarely stabilizes. Why? Because we keep on teaching all the time, always something in our visit related to caretaking parenting education. Because why? Because children change. So there's always anticipatory guidance going on, isn't there? So that's kind of fun to see. But these lower ones, the very bottom one is the mental health problem. So we're seeing that stabilize relatively quickly. And we wonder, well, are people being case managed immediately into other resources so that they can get the help they need? The lighter blue one is, towards the bottom there, is the residence problem. And a lot of surveillance going into residence problem, because what do we do when we go visit families in their homes? We do a home safety checklist. And we might do a lot of teaching about the home safety checklist right away, and then go back and check. In my previous research, I found that behavior change is proportional to the number of times that we check up on people. Here are the survival Kaplan-Meier curves for stabilization outcome for children. And that red line at the top is the growth and development problem. And once again, this mimics the curve for the parenting problem, because there's always something to teach about the next stage of growth and development for a child. The lower two lines, abuse and neglect, stabilize rather quickly. So we're seeing perhaps referral into other resources, or just noticing that surveillance is what is needed here. So I have a question, though. I am wondering if stabilization may indicate interim improvement, or stabilization may indicate resistance to intervention. I don't know if any of you have worked with a pregnant woman who is smoking, and you go to her home and you say, well, how's the smoking going? And she says, you can check with me how my smoking is going, but you cannot try to change my smoking behavior because it is my partner. And so don't go there. It's okay if you come and look. We can talk about everything else, but don't challenge me on my smoking. And so I think there are those situations where we, as public health nurses, the only thing we can do is show up. And I'm wondering if there's these two things going on in this stabilization kind of concept that I'm trying to figure out. So I'm proposing to do a joint study with one of our local public health agencies so I can actually get the intervention data, find out who is stabilizing, and then look at the nurse's notes to see if I can figure out what's going on with that stabilization phenomenon. I don't have that kind of detail in my existing data set. And here's my shameless invitation to all of you. We have an Omaha System partnership. It's international. It consists of a scientific team at the University of Minnesota and affiliate members at the local, national, and international organizations, and a data warehouse of de-identified data that's all Omaha System data looking at health phenomenon for various programs. Our website is omahasystempartnership.org, and you're all welcome to contact me about being an affiliate member. There is no obligation, only opportunity. And what we're doing is we're trying to connect people with relevant clinical public health nursing questions to our data sets and our data partners. And we have many partners throughout the United States and the world who are very interested in connecting. So this is an idea, its time is finally coming, that we're going to be able to use nursing's data to inform nursing's work. And I look forward to working with whoever would like to partner. Thank you. Thank you for the excellent question. I'll repeat it. She wonders if, because of funding eligibility, if that had any impact on when cases closed and the outcomes of care as related to the closure of cases. And the answer is no. This is natural public health nursing practice, and the nurses were able to decide with the clients when to open and close cases. So the funding streams were basically paying nurse salary without looking at eligibility of care. So I don't think we have too many data sets like this right now. So many are all dictated by funding streams. Thank you. Yes? Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, excellent ideas. It's great to finally meet you, Judy. She's in Rochester, Minnesota. I know your name well. I think we have to get to clinical decision support from our data. You know, so what we do is we have expert public health nurses who are making decisions with clients, and the more clues that we can give them in advance, the better off we are. But when you look at this in a trajectory or pattern, okay, this is week 46 that we're serving people who started out with a status rating of 5. Status rating of 5 means no signs or symptoms. These could be brand new moms. They could have a whole host of risk factors. They just don't have signs and symptoms yet. So we don't know from looking at a status 5 what their risks are. We only know that they aren't in trouble right now. So I think there are many dimensions of this that can be helpful, and we just have to figure out what they are, and I invite you to help me propose the study. Yep. Yes, we could adjust for risk factors. The Omaha system doesn't have risk factors, but what we have is comorbidities of various problems. So if we're identifying several problems with one family compared to fewer, I think that is also showing up in my research as another indicator. Fantastic. Let's do that.
I think I've talked to the last person of that.
Mary Jo. No, I have not linked risk factors with problem codes. Yeah, I don't think anyone's done that work, so Open door. Thank you so much.
Put a plug in for the Omaha system. I was an early, what do they call that, adopter. And I met Karen early on, Karen Martin, who started promoting the Omaha system. And I started using students for making home visits. And made them.
It was clear in my head what I wanted to do, but every time I tried to explain it, it's like... So you've got it pretty much what I did. I mean, the problem had to be addressed in the data sample. And then it had to be addressed by more than one kind. Some problems may have just surveillance from the beginning and that didn't count. So it had to be addressed by multiple intervention actions first. And then after that, be addressed by surveillance only. And this is all over time. About a third have a setback. I called it a setback.
Okay.
And then, then the numbers were getting small enough that it was very difficult to tell a pattern, but then we did have people restabilizing and so forth.
My concern is how do we know if stabilization has truly occurred and what we might be seeing is that the PHN has not gone back to critically reevaluate whether or not the answer, you know what I'm saying? And your idea is going back to checking the nodes.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Out of stabilization into requiring brief intervention.
So the trouble with data that we have in databases is that it doesn't have this kind of qualitative component. And yet, we have such a wealth of these data, and it would be a shame not to try to glean from them what we can. So this is sort of the first cut, and then going back and, it's this iterative process that you talked about where we need to have theory to support our data and data to support our theory.
And my question is really generated from having a bit, 10, 15 years of interprofessional nursing, public health, pharmacy, medicine, and social work, using the Omaha business model at the Arizona-Mexico border. And we would see surveillance, but through the process of weekly interprofessional team meeting, when the student presented with the phone and blood, it was like, that's not surveillance anymore, they need to...
Sounds like we have a paper to write, Marilyn. Are you talking about the SIP or the? I think it's yours. Yep.
We're a small school. We have 12 full-time faculty members, probably 6 of which teach on the graduate level. We have 2 for our nurse practitioner program that are joint appointments that they have a practice in the Lehigh Valley Hospital Network and then work half-time there and half-time at our school. Oh, I understand what you're saying. We have 4 different tracks for masters, and this theories course is one of the core courses. So no matter what the students, I wasn't clear enough with that. Yes, it's a core course. So every student rotates through nursing research, epidemiology, and nursing theories as their core before they go into their separate nurse educator. We have a nurse MBA track with our business school. And the different nurse practitioner tracks.
As far as faculty numbers, also 12, we're a very small school of nursing. We only have 1 master's focus, and it's family nurse practitioner.
I see.
Because I'm from the Texas Mexico border, that's what we need.
Yes, you do.
We took a survey to see what would be the second focus that people want, and they chose administration.
Okay.
Our issue is that all of our classes are evenings because people about
sure.
it.
Sure.
And then what do you fit in all this additional 3 to 4 hours? You know,
right.
All of this. I teach leadership and management in the spring, and I would like to incorporate something like this.
It's been wonderful. Wow.
And so, you know, that's our numbers are growing tremendously. We don't have this sort of a component.
Mm-hmm.
We put it in and then we take it out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
To do all of these additional things aside from reading during this chapter.
Sure.
And writing how many papers.
I know. Well, if you have 80 students, maybe they could partner and then you'd only have 40 projects. But in terms of our students, I don't know the way your work environment is, but a lot of our nursing students do the 12-hour shifts where they do 3 12s. So then they do have the days off during the week, and that's when they do their clinicals or they come. But our courses are the evening courses also. A lot of them are the hybrid courses, though, where they only have to come half-time on campus. The other half is independent.
Mm-hmm.
I know, it's very hard. It's very hard. Right. That's right. Sure. That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. You need the baby steps, right? That's right. You do. You do.
Thank you. I was curious, if those faculty cross-teach both in the baccalaureate program and
yeah, the only ones that only teach in the master's program are our joint appointments, the two nurse practitioners. All the other faculty we teach in the undergraduates, the RN to BSN completion, and the grad. So we always joke that we're schizophrenic with our time schedules because everybody's calendar is so different. We have a regular baccalaureate program. We have a traditional baccalaureate program, and we have what's called an accelerated program for second degree students that they complete in 15 months. So their courses are 8 weeks at a time. The traditionals are the full semester, 15 weeks. The graduate students are 12 weeks. And the RNBSNs are 8 weeks. So if you teach across all the programs, you never really have like a spring break off or Christmas big break, you know. So, yeah, they get. The undergraduates do have it. Yes. Yes, we do, for the community health course. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Right. Correct. That's great. That's what. Good. Good. Sure. That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I have a question for Carla. Were you already involved with Ryan Hawaii? How did you get invited to be part of this initiative to change the kit?
Okay, thank you. How did I get invited to be part of this?
How did you start working on this, your project?
For my project?
Yes.
Okay. Well, my background is community health nursing, and I have... Sure. Sorry?
I asked how she got started because it's not a nursing, it wasn't a nursing role, it was really looking at the system, right?
Right. I've had a interesting, I guess, trajectory in my career. So initially I started off as a staff nurse and still have experience as cardiac nursing. I worked as a drug safety surveillance coordinator at a pharmaceutical company, and then I became very interested in epidemiology. Did some work as a clinical educator, And then took a position at the health department as the HIV nurse epidemiologist. And it was then that I started to notice all the trends with African Americans in particular presenting late to care, presenting with an initial HIV and AIDS diagnosis, so dual diagnosis. And then just lots of patterns of just places where we could possibly make a difference in care and treatment. So after 18 months in that role, we received Part A funding from HRSA, and along with that was a position that came open in quality management, and it required that a nurse take that role. So that's kind of how I evolved into this whole thing, and I'm really one of the only nurses in my program, so I have a very different focus. And being at a health department, many of you know, they're not very research-focused and oriented, so we really rely on our academic partnerships quite a bit. So when I need to get that support, you know, fortunately I have it because of my relationship with Indiana University and because I'm a pre-doctoral student.
Thank you.